Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I am a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
When Undisclosed first launched in 2015, the plan that Susan, Colin, and I had was to do a deep investigative look at the facts of Haman Lee's murder and Adnan's conviction, with no plans to move on to other cases. None of the three of us had ever done any innocence work before, and while I had been helping Adnan and his family navigate the appeal system, collecting documents, and trying to raise money for his defense since 1999, I really had no idea how to attack a wrongful conviction. My career had been in federal immigration, civil rights, and national security, the areas in which all the expected fallout from 9/11 were felt. That first season with Susan and Colin was a steep learning curve for me. I learned how to read a police file, how to understand a criminal trial transcript, and how to reinvestigate a case. Susan taught me to be skeptical of every document I read because the police don't always faithfully note down what witnesses say. Colin taught me what issues, like Brady, can get a defendant a new trial. And the most important thing I learned was to put aside the prosecutor's narrative and try to piece together what actually happened in any given crime in a wrongful conviction. For that, I learned to create timelines. Timelines to track the movements of the victim, of your defendant, and of the prime suspects. It's not an easy task decades after the fact, and when the original investigators dropped the ball, on purpose or because of sheer incompetence, the list is long and hearty in this case of all the times the investigators dropped the ball or purposefully avoided collecting evidence they thought would hurt their case. You can clearly see this incompetence when you examine how poorly they investigated the suspects they should have. Alonzo Sellers, who found Hayes' body. The only state's witness, Jay Wiles, who not only changed his story a dozen times, but demonstrated over and over again that his narrative was impossibly wrong. And Donald Kleindienst, Hayes' new boyfriend. The boyfriend that Hay told one of her classmates that she was going to see after school, and the same classmate that a police note says Dawn assaulted. That boyfriend, who apparently never tried to contact Hay again after he was told that she had simply disappeared. That boyfriend was very quickly dismissed after he told the police he was at work on January 13th, 1999, and after they checked with his manager, who said that yes, he was indeed at work.
Now, this claim that Don was at work during the time that Haman Lee disappeared has long been in contention. To refresh your recollection, Hayes' family filed a missing persons report with the Baltimore County Police at around 6 p.m. on January 13, 1999. This was just hours after she was last seen at Woodlawn High School. But the family was worried because she had failed to pick up her young cousin from school and had failed to show up at work at Lens Crafters in Owings Mills, Maryland. The responding officer, Officer Scott Adcock, who took the missing persons report, called the Owings Mills store to see if she was there. Then tried to reach out to her new boyfriend, Don. Hay's brother ended up dialing a number he found in Hay's diary, but it turned out to be Adnan's number and not Don, so Adcock and Adnan spoke briefly. According to Officer Adcock's testimony at trial, he spent the rest of the evening doing paperwork related to the missing persons report and trying to get a hold of Don. Now, Don also worked at the same store as Hay, the Owings Mills Lens Crafters, but he's not there when Adcock calls. Adcock calls Don's home and leaves a message with someone, presumably Don's father, asking Don to call him back. Don does call Adcock back, but not until 1:30 a.m., about 11 hours after Hay disappeared. So the question has always been, where was Don all that time? The totality of what Don told Adcock during this 1:30 a.m. call was that he didn't know where Hay was, and he had last spoken to Hay on January 12th, the night before she disappeared. Adcock doesn't ask Don where he was all day on the 13th, and Don doesn't tell him. Don also doesn't remember at that time that he and Hay had any plans to meet. Then, the next day, on January 14th, another Baltimore County officer calls and speaks to Don. The total sum of the exchange with Don is this line in a police report, quote, "The victim's boyfriend, Don, advised he has not seen the victim since 1/12/99.
It should be baffling to everyone that neither police report mentions what Don was doing on the day that Hay disappeared. How could two different officers not ask the seemingly basic question of the victim's boyfriend? Nonetheless, on January 22, 1999, Detective O'Shea of the Baltimore County Police called Don again to interview him more thoroughly, though the bar was pretty low at this point. Here's what the pertinent part of the report says. Hay told Donald that she would call him after she left work on 1/13/99. Hay was scheduled to work the 1,800 hours to 2,200 hour shift. On 1/13/99, Donald went to work at the Hunt Valley Lenscrafter store. Donald did not speak with Hay while he was at work. Don worked until approximately 1,800 hours. Don arrived home at 1,900 hours, and he was advised by his father to call the Owings Mills store. Don called the store, and he was told that Hay Lee was missing. So, according to Don, he got home at 7 p.m. from work, and his father told him the police were looking for Hay. But Officer O'Shea never asked him why he didn't call the police back until 1:30 a.m. that night. This is, however, the first time we hear that Don was working on the 13th, but not at his usual store. He was working at a different LensCrafters location in the Hunt Valley Mall of Maryland, just filling in for that day because they apparently needed him.
The next known interview with Don isn't done by the police. It's done by Mandy Ennehy, an investigator the family hired privately. Though the date of this interview isn't noted, we do know it's sometime during the last week of January. Her notes read, quote, "Don, co-worker and new boyfriend, contacted both by police and by consultant. Don appeared mature, articulate, but not overly concerned. Although helpful and polite, he did not sound in any way emotionally concerned with Haley's disappearance. He felt she had gone to California to be with her father. But he did state that he hoped she would contact him." Detective O'Shea follows up to verify if Don was indeed working that day. But strangely enough, he apparently doesn't call the Hunt Valley store. Rather, he calls the Owings Mills store, where Don and Hay both work, and speaks to Kathy Michelle, the manager at the store. Here's what the report of the visit says. Quote, "On 2/01/99, O'Shea interviewed CM, a manager at LensCrafters in Owings Mills. CM said Haley was scheduled to work at 1,800 hours on 1/13/99. Hay did not show up for work, nor did she contact anyone. CM said Don was working at the Hunt Valley LensCrafters on 1/13/99. CM said Don arrived for work at 09/02 hours. He took a lunch break from 13/10 to 13/42 hours. He left work at 1,800. In other words, the manager confirmed that Don worked on January 13th from 9:02 a.m. to 6 p.m. and took a lunch break from 1:10 to 1:42 p.m. Then, a few days later, on February 4th, 1999, the detective actually visited Don at the Owings Mills store, and the result is a single line in report that states that Don is given the same information as he did before.
After this point, Don was simply eliminated as a suspect in Hay's disappearance. Remember, Hay's body has not yet been found. But after it is found on February 9, 1999, and the case turns into a homicide investigation, Don is still never looked at again. In fact, Don is never again contacted by the police after Hay's body is found. His fingerprints, hair, and DNA were never collected to compare to the forensics. The police don't ask for his time cards from work, talk to anyone he may have worked with, and they fail to realize the manager who vouched for him at the Owings Mills store was his mother's girlfriend. They also fail to learn that the manager at the Hunt Valley store where he says he was filling in on January 13th was his actual mother, Anita Baird. The entire investigation going forward ends up focusing on Adnan, and the police never take another look at Don. In fact, in March of 1999, after Adnan was arrested, a defense investigator by the name of Andrew Davis spoke to a police source and then wrote this note in his report. Quote, "Davis was able to speak to a police official who was involved in this investigation. Davis was advised by the subject that all alibis provided by Don, Hay's current boyfriend, were confirmed, and that he had been completely ruled out as a possible suspect. P.D. Davis was also assured that the police had an airtight case against Adnan Syed in this case. The police official was confident that they had, in fact, arrested the correct person." September of 1999 is the first time anyone asks for Don's actual work records. Adnan's attorney, Christina Gutierrez, subpoenaed them in preparation for trial. Long story short, the time card that was produced that showed that Don worked at Hunt Valley on the day Hay disappeared has actually raised more questions than answers.
In a blog post from March 15, 2015, titled Serial, The Question of Don's Alibi, Susan Simpson broke down all the issues with this time card, which for a number of reasons seems to have been falsified. We went over these issues in season one of this podcast as well, but in brief, these are the major glaring problems we saw with the timesheet. One, Don's employee number is different at both stores, which it shouldn't be. Two, employee numbers are assigned sequentially to hires, and Don's employee number at the Hunt Valley store indicates he was hired before his mother and general manager Anita Baird, which was unlikely. Three, the shift that he apparently covered for doesn't actually exist at that store. And four, the hours in the time card don't add up. Then, there is work disciplinary records from 1999, which indicate that the other employees have trust issues with Don, that he has integrity issues, that he doesn't communicate well and blames others for his mistakes, and that he, quote, needed to understand the possible consequences of falsifying company documents. The question of whether the Hunt Valley time card was falsified has been examined at length in various media, including by investigator and podcaster Bob Ruff in his Truth and Justice podcast, and by the team that produced the HBO documentary, The Case Against Adnan Syed. The conclusions reached by each of these investigations were different. Bob Ruff, who interviewed 16 former LensCrafters employees and delved into how the computerized system works, concluded the timesheet is not reliable and likely falsified. The documentary team, though, hired investigators who came to the conclusion the difference in employee numbers was not suspect and that the computerized system could not be manipulated manually to falsify timesheets without leaving a trace, although the hours in the time card not adding up seems to be such a trace.
While it's up in the air whether the different employee numbers are a red flag or not, there is almost no way the Hunt Valley time card is completely reliable, according to Susan Simpson. Here's how she put it in an email. Quote, the LensCrafters employees that QRI, the documentary investigation team, spoke to were never actually asked about the Hunt Valley time card discrepancy. But this time card discrepancy is proof that either some manual alteration of Don's time card was in fact possible or that their system is unreliable when it comes to calculating employee time. Something is unquestionably wrong here. The timekeeping system could be manipulated somehow. Until that discrepancy is explained, I do not believe the reliability of the time cards can or should be assumed, especially since there does not appear to be any legitimate reason for Don's hours at Hunt Valley to have been manually adjusted. Now, this blurb is from a much longer email that Susan sent to Amy Berg, the director of the documentary, when they were investigating the issue. And of course, as part of the investigation, Amy's team contacted a number of LensCrafters former employees, including all the employees that worked at the Hunt Valley store in January of 1999. One of those employees was a woman by the name of Deborah Renner, who in turn reached out to me after the documentary team had shown her the time cards and other case documents, and it jogged a memory for her. Susan interviewed Deborah, but we decided to backburner her statements just in case Adnan had to go back to trial. Well, he won't ever be going back to trial, so now we don't have to sit on this anymore. This episode is the first time the world gets to hear from Deborah.
My name is Deborah Renner, and I worked for LensCrafters from 1995 until 2000.
Deborah's employment with LensCrafters overlapped with both Don's employment and his mother Anita's employment at the Hunt Valley store.
Somewhere in that 5 years, Anita started managing LensCrafters at Hunt Valley Mall. I was a manager in training, and her son worked in the lab making the glasses. He didn't come immediately when she started. He started later. He was there for a while until LensCrafters made a new rule that employees could not work with family members in the same store. His mother had a girlfriend named Kathy Michaels, who was also a co-manager at Hunt Valley. And so that was the first person to get transferred out was her girlfriend, Kathy. I think she went to the Towson location. And then her son worked in the lab and he got transferred to Owings Mills.
Given the comments by coworkers about Don's disciplinary records, it's not surprising that this is how Debbie felt about him.
I tried to avoid Don because he gave me the creeps. Very, very dark personality. The way he would look at you, very, just very creepy. And he was a lot younger than I am, but I got a bad vibe.
Dawn creeping others out is not the reason Deborah reached out to me. Rather, she reached out because after she met with the documentary producers, she had a recollection that left her feeling uncomfortable about her role in the case.
Well, I first found out about this case. It was hidden from me. Back then, I wasn't a news watcher. It was very hush-hush in LensCrafters because I knew nothing about it until a producer for the HBO documentary series contacted me in, I want to say 2016 or 2016, and met this producer at the Starbucks in Cockeysville. She brought the time cards with her, which blew my mind looking at this stuff, like, wow. She brought a summons for me that I never received for the trial. This was all new to me, and I really racked my brains about that time period because it had been so long ago, and that's when different memories came up. I was just starting to get some memories back about a particular incident that happened that really bothered me because I felt like my manager, Anita, had used me to help her create her son back into the computer in the Hunt Valley location the same day the police came.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, we're going to take a quick ad break, and I just want to explain something to you about why it's so important for you guys to support our sponsors. You might not know this, but all these years, all the work we have done for all of the defendants whose cases we reinvestigate and cover has been pro bono. We don't charge them or their families or their lawyers a dime. And the only way we can afford to do this, which this is work that would ordinarily cost a defendant hundreds of thousands of dollars, the only way we can afford to do this is because of our sponsors. So we are so grateful to our sponsors, and we are grateful to all of you. If you want to know what you can do to help support our work, support our sponsors. Thank you so much.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V26 Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Visit Lowe's and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18. Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
So let's first start with the part about the police coming to the Hunt Valley LensCrafters store. This is completely new information. Nowhere in the police file does it reflect the police ever went to visit the Hunt Valley store. Now remember, investigators did most of their questioning about Don's day over the phone and visited him once, but that was at the Owings Mills store. If Deborah is right about this visit, it means no police report was made about it. And you have to wonder why. Is Deborah right about this visit? It seems her memory of the visit is accompanied by some very strong emotions she attached to it.
And I had no idea why the police came. And I remember I had my feelings hurt because I was, you know, in early management. And they went back into the manager's office, Anita and Charles Kerbine, who was the lab manager. That was Don's boss when he was at that location. And I wanted to go with them to see what was going on, maybe being nosy. And they said that I couldn't come back. And I guess I got my little girl feelings hurt, like felt like they were, like, I wanted to know what was going on.
Deborah remembers that Anita, Don's mother, and Charles Kirby, the lab manager, spent nearly an hour with the police before emerging from the meeting. But the police didn't speak to Deborah, and she was never told what the meeting was about. She wasn't even aware that a LensCrafters employee was missing and was later discovered murdered. It wasn't until 17 years later, when she met the documentary producers, that she realized what had happened that day. But it was what happened before the police arrived that was really bothering her.
And I remember that earlier that day that Anita and Charles Kerbine were on the computer, which was at our front counter. And they were trying to do something on the computer and they looked really frustrated. And I walked over to them and they said they were trying to get Don into our system. Because once an employee left and got into another store's location, it was hard to re-enter them into another location.
Right. And I think they end up having a different employee number too at that point.
Yes. Yes. When they went to the other location, they had a different employee number. So they were trying to get Don back into the computer. And like I said, I'm not great on computers, but I said, let me try. And I don't know what I did, whether I did it without a middle initial or something, but I was able to get him in and they were like ecstatic that I got him in because they were unable to do it. And I was kind of like, I was like a little fool of myself because like I said, I wasn't too great on computers. I'm like, haha, I got it. I got him in. And when that memory came back to me, it bothered me so bad because I thought to myself, about the way they were acting when all that happened. Mm-hmm. I felt like his mom was giving Don an alibi.
So let's break down what Deborah remembers here. First, she seems to remember that when employees change stores, they get a new employee number. That seems to put the question of why Don had different numbers to rest. Although it does make us wonder what employee number Don had before he was transferred from Hunt Valley to Owings Mills. Was there yet a third number? Regardless, it's interesting that Deborah remembers having to make some kind of change to get Don back into the Hunt Valley system, a change like perhaps adding a middle initial. Well, guess what? That is indeed another one of the differences between the two time cards from the different locations. The time card from Hunt Valley that shows Don worked there on January 13, 1999, meaning the only one that may have been falsified by Anita, has an additional middle initial that Don's Owings Mills time card does not. We asked Deborah why Anita and Charles told her they were trying to add Don back into the system, and she was told they may be calling him back to work that location again once in a while. Did you though?
But let me ask you this. Do you remember whether or not, after Don left because of the policy change, if he ever came back to work at that store?
No. And I know that, I know he didn't because, like I said, this guy gave me the creeps and I was happy he was gone and I never had to see him again because I, you know, there's not too many people give me the creeps. This guy gave me the creeps and life was a lot better without him there.
Both Charles and Deborah, by the way, were on schedule and worked all day on January 13th, 1999, the only day that really matters in this case at all. And if Deborah Renner is right, and Don never returned to Hunt Valley after being transferred to Owings Mills, it can only mean that Don's January 13th timesheet was falsified.
Right, and if he came in on the 13th, according to my records, it says I was there, and he wasn't there when I was there.
You were there on the 13th?
I was there that day.
All right, well.
So he never came while I was there.
When the producers met with Deborah, she was also shocked to learn that she had been subpoenaed for Adnan's trial, because the subpoena never actually reached her. She wondered if it had been served at LensCrafters and intercepted by someone, so she never got it. She also wonders about why this happened.
What happened was, right after this all happened with the police coming, all of a sudden, I got transferred to the Annapolis location. And I was not happy because I live in Cockeysville, and that is a hike. I was happy. It was a promotion. As far as
you, like, who would have had that power to do that?
Oops, Anita.
All these decades later, there's no real way to corroborate Deborah's statements. The lab manager she says was there when the police came, Charles Kerbeam, passed away before we heard from Deborah Renner, and of course Anita Baird will not divulge if any of this came to pass. How could this case have gone if the police or defense investigators had actually spoken to Deborah or others that Don should have worked with on January 13th? Or if Deborah had gotten the subpoena and actually testified at trial? The bottom line is what an absolute abject failure this investigation into this case was, both when it was a missing persons case and then when it became a homicide case. And that stands true from both the police and defense sides. In no way was Don properly eliminated as a suspect by the state before they moved on to Adnan and never looked back.
To this day, 26 years later, we are still trying to eliminate Don as a suspect. And in order to do so, I turned again to Dr. Ann Burgess's investigative group. You'll remember my discussions with them from a couple of episodes ago about Alonzo Sellers. Well, when I presented the findings of Hay's autopsy report, something else leaped out at the group. And it wasn't the lividity, which is what most of our focus has been on in the past. What caught the attention of a number of forensic professionals in the group were the injuries that Hay had suffered on the right side of her head. These injuries were always a bit confusing because while there were no contusions or fractures in her skull or even external cuts to her head, there were two locations in which she had bleeding inside her scalp. In March of 2015, Colin wrote a blog post about these injuries where he says this.
The autopsy report for Lee indicated that she had a right occipital subgaleal hemorrhage, as well as a right temporalis muscle hemorrhage. The experts I've heard from are all in agreement that such hemorrhaging likely was not the result of punches, and almost certainly not the result of punches thrown from inside the cozy confines of the 1998 Nissan Sentra. This has allowed me to draw my third conclusion. It's possible that the blunt force injuries could have been caused by punches, but it is likelier they were caused by a weapon or Lee's head striking some fixed object.
Colin goes on then to write this.
As I noted in a prior post, a subgaleal hemorrhage is blood pooling on the skull below the galea aponeurotica. The amount of force required to produce such a hemorrhage is significant. In another prior post, the causes I listed for such hemorrhage were 1. A 6 to 8 foot fall downstairs, leading to the victim's head striking the basement floor. 2. A victim falling into a pond and striking her head on some object in the pond. 3. Car accidents. 4. A victim falling 12 feet while pole vaulting. And 5. A victim falling 6 feet into an empty pool. As I also noted in a prior post, a temporalis muscle hemorrhage is blood pooling in the temporalis muscle. Again, the amount of force required to produce such a hemorrhage is significant. Each of the examples I cited in which victims suffered temporalis muscle hemorrhages involved car accidents.
There is one possibility about the origin of these injuries that the blog post does not discuss, though, because frankly, I don't think anybody thought about it. Not until the super sleuths looked at it. And that possibility opened up an entirely new scenario to all of us, including Sarah Kalin, regarding what may have happened to Hay.
I mean, this case and that particular meeting was an unbelievable learning experience for me because this was one I had not seen. So the type of injury we're talking about was in an area behind, kind of like that notch behind your head, like in between where the middle of your neck is and your ear is. There's like that little quadrant of the head. And what it was called the subgaleal hematoma. And so there's a bleed, like what we would think of as a brain bleed, but there was not like injury to the skull that would necessarily indicate it was from a blow, right? Yeah. So, and I too, like prior to understanding this about the subgaleal hematomas, I too thought this could have happened in a car, which would explain having fewer wounds, right? Like hair, like she's grabbed, her head is hit up against a car window if like she's in the passenger seat, and then a strangulation happens and it happens very quickly, and that might be why we don't see that. However, present at this meeting was Dr. Michelle Patch from Johns Hopkins University, who is one of the world's foremost experts in strangulation violence, but also because so much of her work centers in interpersonal violence and domestic violence, she has studied a lot of other markers that we see, you know, in these things. And so as this meeting is going on, Michelle, Dr. Patch, is sending me links to a medical journal. I'm reading them and I'm like, oh my God, this is huge. And so she then, you know, brings it up in this meeting. And this is like, there have been a series of studies that demonstrate that this particular type of subgaleal hematoma, anywhere on the head, the location doesn't necessarily matter, but like without impact trauma, can indicate a really hard hair pull. If you have sisters, you know, and if they're coming at you, or if you have your back turned, right, and you're trying to run away from one and they grab the back of your head, that's where they're gonna get that. And if they yank you down hard enough to put you on the ground, From these studies that I was like reading and then have since read much, you know, much more deeply on it, you'd be surprised how little much like of a hair pull it would actually take to create this. I mean, it's more than just if like you're brushing your hair too hard or whatever, but it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody ripped out a chunk of your hair. It's just the suddenness that the strength with which this person is pulled creates that bleed in the brain. And for Dr. Patch looking at this, she was like, obviously without looking at, you know, at the actual like autopsy photos or, you know, a brain scan or something, she doesn't want to fully just assert that. But she's like, this feels like a really strong possibility.
If these injuries were caused by violent hair pulling, well, according to the group of experts on the call, hair pulling is more commonly associated with assaults by women, particularly in interpersonal conflicts. It's less typical in male-on-male or even male-on-female violence, where more forceful methods are often used. Now, the studies on this are scarce, but anecdotal evidence is plentiful that hair pulling is more frequently reported when the female partner is the aggressor in intimate partner violence. And of course, those of us that grew up with siblings know that this is the go-to move in a fight between sisters.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
The possibility of a female perpetrator being involved in Hayes' murder is not new to us. Ever since an unidentified female DNA was found in some of the evidence in this case, we've wondered about the possibility of a woman being involved. You may recall that back in 2018, the Maryland Attorney General tested a list of items collected from the crime scene in Hayes' person. Among these items, unknown female DNA was identified on two pieces of evidence. I wrote about this in 2019 in a blog post, and here's what I noted. First, swabs from item 12, the shorter wire, yielded a single source, female DNA profile. That profile is that of an unknown female number one. Given that they were able to conclude that Haman Lee was the source for other DNA profiles and other evidence, it seems safe to conclude that this other female was not Haman Lee. Additionally, the DNA testing report stated that the left fingernail clipping yielded one indeterminate minor allele from a female source that was not Haman Lee.
All these new insights from the Super Sleuths group and the unsourced female DNA found in the forensic testing had my head reeling. In any good investigation, you start with those closest to the victim and try to rule them out. In this case, though, we had two strong alternate suspects that had not been ruled out, Alonzo Sellers and Dawn Kleindienst. Sarah's first instinct was to focus on any women in the lives of these two suspects, and she began where her gut told her to, with the women in Dawn's life. Why? Because, according to the investigative report that Sarah eventually drafted, quote, there is scientific data to suggest that the most prevalent motivator from female-on-female violence involves competition or the perception thereof of a male partner. So, was there a woman in Dawn's life that may have seen Hay as competition? The only other woman that we have ever known to be romantically involved in Dawn's life is his wife, Robin. And by the way, I thought about anonymizing her, but I didn't see the point because a simple Google search reveals who she is. Anyway, Sarah discovered that Dawn and Robin, who was only 19 years old in 1999, both had addresses in Rosedale, Maryland when Hay disappeared. Could they have known each other then? Maybe. And while we know that the two were dating at the time of Adnan's trial because Robin came with Dawn to the trial, we weren't exactly sure when they started dating, and frankly, no one had taken a second or even first look at her. But Sarah's curiosity was piqued when she learned through previous investigative reports that Robin worked recently as an ophthalmic assistant. Weird, right, that Robin worked in kind of the same field as Dawn and Hay back in 1999. Next, Sarah did a simple public record search and found the following, detailed in her investigative report. Quote, Mrs. Kleindienst, in fact, hails from the Baltimore area and was living in the area at the time of Miss Lee's murder. These records also show that Mrs. Kleindienst, then still Miss Kelly, and Mr. Kleindienst began cohabitating in the Baltimore area in 2000. Alerted to the possibility that the now married couple may have already been involved romantically at the time Mr. Kleindienst dated Miss Lee, this investigator explored Mrs. Kleindienst's history further.
In 2023, Sarah interviewed Kathy Michelle Baird. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because it's the same Kathy Michelle who was Dawn's mother's girlfriend back in 1999. And yes, also the same Kathy who was the manager of the Owings Mills Lenscrafters, where Haman Lee and Dawn both worked. Kathy and Anita eventually married, and Kathy changed her last name to Michelle Baird. According to Kathy, Robin also worked at Lenscrafters at the same time that Dawn and Hay did, although not in the same location. Kathy recalled that before working at Lenscrafters, Robin was employed at a shoe store, though she couldn't remember which store. This is worth noting because around the same time that Robin would have been working at a shoe store, Dawn's father was a manager at a Payless shoe store. Maybe a coincidence, maybe not. So while it's not clear when Dawn and Robin began dating, their work history seems to suggest their paths may have crossed before Dawn began seeing Hay in December of 1998. In her investigation, Sarah also raises the fact that Hay wrote about her first date with Dawn being all the way out in Aberdeen, Maryland, about an hour away from where Hay lived and where they both worked. It's all total speculation, of course, but is it possible that Dawn took Hay that far away for their date to avoid being spotted locally because maybe he already had a girlfriend? Is it possible that girlfriend found out, confronted Hay, and something terrible happened that no one planned? Sure, it's possible. This line of questioning is what an investigator would call an important lead. But Sarah herself notes that none of this information rules out other possible female suspects in the victim's orbit. But before moving on to other female suspects, it's important to eliminate this very significant one. After all, for all intents and purposes, if this investigation had been done with integrity, Adnan would have been eliminated as a suspect long ago. No forensic evidence, not the DNA, hair from Hay's body, or fingerprints from her car matches him. He had multiple alibis, and his phone records disprove the testimony and statements of the prosecution's only witness, and really their only evidence, Jay Wilds. The same young man who, according to his own attorney, was threatened with being charged with the murder of Heyman Lee if he didn't turn state's witness, and he was given a secret deal that basically gave him immunity from ever spending a day in prison.
Anyway, since the authorities failed to eliminate anyone else as suspects, Sarah tried to do just that. She traveled down south to attempt to meet with Don and Robin Kleindienst. While she never got face-to-face with Don, Sarah did speak to Robin. But Robin refused to be interviewed, and she refused to voluntarily provide a DNA swab. So Sarah did what a good investigator does in such situations. She waited, patiently, in the middle of the night for the Kleindienst to put out their trash, and then she nabbed some of it. I know, that sounds like it should not be legal, right? I mean, we all put out our trash, and it feels like our trash should be private. But guess what? In most states, once trash is out on the curb, it goes from being private to public property. Do with that what you will. Anyway, Sarah then heroically combed through the trash in her hotel room and found the items most likely to yield DNA. And they did. The lab that we sent the items to gave us two complete male DNA profiles and one partial female profile. These profiles were part of the report that was turned over to Baltimore State's attorney's office a few months ago. Ivan Bates, are you listening? You have unsourced DNA on Hayes' shoes, and we've given you the DNA of the prime suspect Baltimore police failed to eliminate. Do your job, Mr. Bates. Compare the DNA from Hayes' shoes to the profiles we provided. It's the least you can do, especially given your history with this case. Next time on Undisclosed.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Hey guys, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Want to give a quick shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production and Animal Weapon for our theme music. This time around, we're doing something different. You can leave us questions, comments, thoughts, and suggestions in a voice note, and we might even play it on air. Just go to speakpipe.com/undisclosed and start recording. For those of you that want to engage on social media, you can follow, share, and like us on all the different platforms. We're on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. For folks on X, we're still at Undisclosed Pod. Also, please go to subscribe to our new YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod so you don't miss out on any content there. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our revamped website at undisclosedpod.com. If you want to follow Colin and Rabia on social media as well, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram, and Colin is at EvidenceProf on Instagram and Blue Sky. Thanks for your continued support for us and for our sponsors. Until next time.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.